Let me survey you a minute. I get the impression that the young people are taking over. Is that what? Where are the old people? Would you raise your hand if you're an old person? Okay. By the way, we're glad you kids are here. Did you hear about the international symposium where they met to try to decide whether what was the race of Adam and Eve, what was their nationality? So they broke up into national groups, the Germans over here and the Japanese and the Chinese and the all the different nations and races. And they came back together and they were reporting. And when it got to the Chinese delegation, they said, well, we know they weren't Chinese. We know Adam and Eve were not Chinese. And everybody said, well, how did you know that? They said if they'd been Chinese, they would have thrown the apple away and eaten the snake. Now, if you know China, we heard that in Singapore. I think a Chinese told us that, so that's not a racist joke. They themselves, they know they eat anything. But that's just a joke. You know, it's not really real. And you say, well, why did you tell it? Because even in the world, people are aware of the Hebrew writings. It's always been like this. The people back in the time when, before the coming of Christ, the Hebrew nation, they were hated, but their writings were admired. The Gentile nations, the Greeks and the Romans, they were enamored with the Hebrew writings. And it just amazes me at the fact that we have that kind of awareness of the Hebrew scriptures and the admiration that people who are not Jewish people have for them. What I referred to about Adam and Eve, what book does it occur in? Mostly Genesis. And you think, well, Genesis in the year 2000? Genesis in the third millennium? What connection could that possibly have to us in this modern computer age? There is nothing that could be said that is more relevant to your faith than what we're going to be studying for the next 2 or 3 weeks. And here's the reason why we're doing it. I was talking with John Dixon one day several weeks ago, and we were talking about what should we be studying. And I said, well, I've been thinking that there needs to be a study done that will give the students a broad overview of the whole picture. Not just the New Testament, but a picture of the whole picture. And he said, strangely enough, I was thinking that same thing as I was driving into town, I think he said. So when the two of those minds came together in agreement, we just concluded that really is what you need. And so that's what we're going to be doing. And for this reason, we want you to know that what you are a part of is not some Johnny-come-lately thing that has been concocted out of some human being's imagination, that somebody's trying to pull the wool over on your eye or on your eyes, but that you're a part of a movement whose roots reach back at least 4,000 years. And then to decide whether or not you want to have a part in extending the fruit of it. The root extends back 4,000 years, but you are a part of the fruit of that root. How far past you will this movement go? Each one of us has to make that decision. But I just want you to know that we're a part of something that is so exciting and so eternal and so absolutely saturated with historical documentation, it's going to blow our socks off. So hold on to your socks. Today we're going to be looking at this question here. Where's volume one? That's what we'll look at it in just a minute. We're going to address the unity of this book. And look here. I've only brought my New Testament. Isn't that an indictment of me? Even before I stand up, I brought only it. Can't believe I did that. Then the second week, next week, we're going to be looking at the faith factor. And we're going to be we're going to be exploring the nature of faith and the accessibility of faith to us today in this modern scientific age. Is faith an outmoded something that you can forget about? And we're going to come to see that faith in God is not much different than being hit by a car. Think about it. And we'll get more into that next week. But it's about the same as being hit by a car. The implications and the consequences are much higher and are much broader. But it's about like being hit by a car. And then the third week, we're going to be looking at the bottom line, and we're going to be exposing the backbone of the Bible. Brother Gent just had his backbone. Did they expose your whole backbone or just part of it when they operated on your back?
Part.
Just part of it. We're going to do better than that. We're going to expose the whole backbone of the Bible. So that's what's coming up for the next 3 weeks. There was a woman to whom this volume was given. She had never read the Bible, but they gave her a copy of the New Testament. She was absolutely amazed. She read it all the way through. She read it again. And I think she read it the third time, and she brought it back just absolutely exhilarated, and she said, "But where is volume one?" Oh my, where is volume one? She had gotten the idea that there was something back before that, that this was dependent upon and out of which this had grown. Well, there is a connectedness between the Jewish writings. Well, here's a whole Bible right here. Let me just hold it up. There's a connectedness between this part back here, which is about two-thirds of the whole Bible. There's a connectedness between this and this that is so pronounced that to read the one without the other is going to leave you confused and uninformed, or it's going to leave you confused and misinformed in a sense, at least not complete. To read the Old Testament without the New is like going to a movie and leaving at intermission. To read the New Testament without the Old is like going in to see a movie at intermission. You understand the analogy? You understand that? To have either one without the other leaves us without the whole story. And we want to get the whole story. This interconnectedness is so pronounced, it's so outstanding and pronounced, that the Jews who did not convert to Christ, they accused us initially. One of their first accusations against us was that we had stolen their scriptures. Now you think about being a Jew, and here comes this upstart sect, which at first was just a Jewish sect. But then there was this split between the Jewish people and the disciples of Jesus of Nazareth. And they accused us, and this is documented, they accused us of stealing their scriptures. It started out like this. We stole first their songbook. We stole their songbook, which was what? Well, what is the Jewish songbook? The Psalms. That's all the early Christians had to sing was the Psalms. And so we stole their songbook. It was an inside job, incidentally. They were all Jews at first, and many of their Jews took their songbook and adapted it to the Christian faith and began singing those psalms. But let me give you quickly some things to think about. The first sermon, if you want to just kind of track along with me in the book of Acts, the first sermon used three major Jewish prophecies. Three major Jewish prophecies. And I'm going to more or less assume, a broad knowledge, at least a broad knowledge of what's happening in the New Testament writings, in the Christian writings. The very first sermon on the first day that the church was established and it went public, they used three very distinct Jewish prophecies. That was the basis of the sermon. Secondly, the first defense of that faith in the third chapter cites Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Moses, Samuel, and all the prophets. Now that's the first defense that was made after they beat the stuffing out of the apostles. Well, before they beat them, they made this proclamation that all that had been prophesied back to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Moses and Samuel and all the prophets, God fulfilled. And then the first prayer, after they were beaten, they went back to their group and they prayed the prayer that said that David's prophecy has now come true. Why do the Gentiles rage and the rulers imagine vain things? And why were the kings gathered together against the Lord and against His anointed? And he quotes David, and that's another Jewish prophecy. The first martyr, who was the first martyr? Who? We're going to have to get more vocal. This is being recorded, and they're going to think that you don't know what you're talking about. Who was the first Christian martyr? That's better. Do you have any idea how many Old Testament scriptures he used in his defense in Acts 6? He pulled the whole nine yards into this defense. There are over 100 references to the Old Testament in that first martyr's sermon. Over 100. This next figure, you'll have to be cautious about it, because as I did this research initially about 10 years ago, I revised much of what we're doing, but the research that I did to show you the interconnectedness of the Christian writings or the movement to the Jewish movement, I counted, and you'll have to give me, don't quote me, although it's being recorded, we'll erase it. I counted 330 Old Testament references in the first book alone, in Matthew. Now that sounds like an awful lot. I think what I did was I included all of the names of the genealogy of Jesus Christ. That's 120 right there. So that may be where I got 330. But you know, it was written to the Jewish people, and sure enough, there are lots and lots of Jewish quotations there in that book of Matthew. But I don't know that there are 330. Put a question mark by that, if you would. But the disciples were just following Jesus' lead. I didn't count all the times that he referred to the prophecies that he fulfilled, but I want to show you something. I brought you something that to confuse you. And you're not going to be able to read this, but I'm putting it down for a purpose. Well, it's clearer than I thought. You see, those that I marked, those down at the bottom there, and all those up there that are marked, and then all those that with the straight line, and then all those that are dotted, but especially the ones that are in that block, those two blocks that are marked, those are the references that are used in the New Testament to document the identity of the Jesus that's prophesied in the Old Testament. So here, it's not just our interpreting something and laying it upon Jesus. This is the Scriptures themselves documenting and the fulfillment of those Old Testament prophecies. Now, the one where that line just straight down, these are things that Christians have then, in, as a result, identified themselves. But this is, they're just simply on the outside looking in and saying this referred to Jesus because of all these others that the Bible itself referred to. So you find this much documentation is just from a concordance. So I didn't really trace all of that out, but I did do this. I just took what Jesus referred to, what he referred to that came out of the book of Genesis. Now let's just notice it quickly, because you know these stories anyway. In Matthew 9 and 4, he refers to that God made them male and female. Well, that's a reference back to Genesis 2. Then one flesh is another reference, though it's in the same context, the next verse, Genesis 2:24. And then the blood of Abel is mentioned in Matthew 23, back to Genesis 4. The flood is mentioned in Matthew 24, Jesus said, and that's referring back to Genesis 7. Satan is a murderer. Abraham, Lot's wife, Sodom, Many of these occur in the first 11 chapters of the book of Genesis. Do you have any reason to think that that's relevant to today? Many of the references that Jesus made are referring back to Genesis 1 through 11. Why is that pertinent? It's there that the critics of the Jewish Christian religion, it's there that they direct their fiercest attack and say, that's just fable. It's not really true. It's just somebody was writing and they created this story. Well, Jesus, much of his reference, or many of his references, refer back to those events in Genesis 1 through 11. Oh, wow. Well, those are just some things that will help you realize the enormous interconnectedness between the Christian religion and that of the Jewish people. If you need further evidence or further documentation, Romans, 1st and 2nd Corinthians, Galatians, Hebrews, 1st and 2nd Peter, Jude, and that probably is not complete, but all of these draw heavily on Hebrew history. They draw heavily upon Hebrew writings, Hebrew scripture. And they do this for us. They complete the cycle. Christianity is not something that's just a scattered bunch of information that's blown out at you like a shotgun that doesn't have any connectedness at all. The Bible is one gigantic drama. One gigantic drama that starts with the creation and ends with the ultimate recreation. And in between, you have the creation, the fall, you have the flood, you have all of these efforts of God to bring us wounded, crippled human beings back to Him. And it then completes the cycle as it goes through this enormously long period of time, thousands of years, 4,000 years at least prior to Christ for Abraham. You've got whatever the length of time from the creation until Christ, and then you've got all of this interconnectedness, and it's all laid out before us as a final, complete, well-rounded drama that includes you and me, and that it began somewhere, and it's going to end somewhere, and it's going to end at the recreation of that which was ruined in the creation. Now, does that surprise you or not? You probably knew all that to begin with, but I wanted to make sure you understood it. I did some research, and here again, this isn't current, and I'm sorry it's not. Do you know how many books that the Library of Congress, Richard Halverson, who was the chaplain of the U.S. Senate back in about 1980 through about 95, somewhere in there. I've got it here. You know how many, he asked one day, let me tell you what he said. Some months ago, this is Richard Halverson, the chaplain. Some months ago, I asked a young man who works in my office in Washington if he could call the Library of Congress and ask them how many books have been written about Jesus. He reported this back to me. When he asked the question of one of the librarians, the librarian laughed and then quoted from the last verse of the Gospel of John. If everything that Jesus said and did were written in a book, I suppose the world would not contain them. Then he added, you know, we don't have a computer system that can collate the books that have been written about Jesus Christ. Well, Alex, that was in 1989. You know what's happened in 89 till now. In fact, let me just tell you what's happened from 89 till now. In 1992, you sold me a computer that you told me that this would do me till the Lord comes. Can you believe that? This computer guru sold me a computer that he said, oh, this will do you till the Lord returns. The Lord delayed, you say. Okay, this is not up to date. This is 1989. There were 100,000 books, 100,115 books That was what they had referenced, or that's what they had recorded, or in their stock, or in their shelves in the Library of Congress. But that was 1989. That's what, 17, 18 years ago. So it's completely out of date. I can't find the reference that to this next quote, but do you know how many songs have been written about Jesus Christ and how many exist right now that have been, they've been recorded and they've been, copyrighted? Over 200,000 songs about Jesus Christ. Whoa. Now that doesn't even mention the ones about his daddy, about his father. When you add the number of songs written by people about Jesus, and you combine that with the ones that were written about God, and you've got thousands and thousands. In fact, one of these statements here, he said, think about this. A Jewish carpenter, 33 years of age, died an ignominious death as a common criminal by the worst kind of capital punishment in that day. The books that have been written about him cannot be contained in the world. Millions of titles. This is what Halverson, I think, says. Millions of titles about Jesus. He entered history to obey his heavenly Father. He entered history as a servant, even if it meant death. But my goodness, and then you add one more contingent to it. Think how many times every day that someone uses the name of Jesus Christ in profanity. Think about it. Oh, Buddha. Who in the world ever heard of anyone say, well, Buddha, damn it? Have any of you ever heard anybody say that? Buddha, damn it? I never have. But have you heard somebody say, God, damn it? Yeah. Or Jesus Christ, and it just rolls off their tongue. How many, millions and millions of times every day, they lift the, you know why they do that? Subconsciously, what they're asking to be done to this enemy of theirs or this idiot in front of them, the only one they can think of that's high enough with authority to really bring it down on them, it's not Buddha. It's not anybody else but Jesus Christ or his Father. Yeah. Now that's a backdoor way of saying we acknowledge him as the highest authority we know. You think about it. Well, I'm just so sorry. I am so saddened that the Jewish people have walked out at intermission. It just breaks my heart to think of their walking out at intermission. And they've missed the whole point. There's a book that some of you may have had to read. Do you recognize this book, any of you? The Case for Christ? Some of you have it as a required reading. Well, if you haven't had it as required reading, I'm requiring it. Go get a copy of this and read it. And the story here that I have opened up to is a man by the conversion of a man by the name of Louis Lapides. Louis Lapides. He was a Jewish person. And his life was spinning out of control. His parents were just Jews nominally. They went only on a high day once a year. They didn't keep a kosher table. They certainly weren't Orthodox Jews. But they divorced when he was about 17. That threw him into a tailspin. Not only were they not consistent with their religion in their expression of it, they weren't consistent in their religion as to what it should do. He came to the conclusion, if religion can't preserve that's the most precious to it, what's the use of it? So the crack in the wall began to open up. And then he decided one day to go down to a street in Los Angeles where a man had tied himself to a cross. He had had a storefront ministry preaching Christ, and he had chained himself to that cross preaching because of what the merchants in that community had done to evict him out of his storefront ministry. They didn't want him in there. And he looked at the man, like he was a complete idiot for doing such a thing. And then this man, Lee Strobel, interviewed this Jewish person who had in the meantime become a Christian and was now preaching Jesus Christ. He's one of the leaders in the Jews for Jesus. This man, Lapides. When I interjected to ask what his parents had taught him about the Messiah, Lapides' answer was crisp. It never came up, he said matter-of-factly. I was incredulous. In fact, I thought I had misunderstood him. You mean you're saying it wasn't even discussed? Never, he reiterated. I didn't even remember it being an issue in Hebrew school. This was amazing to me, Strobel says. Well, how about Jesus, I ask? Was he ever talked about? Was his name ever used? Only derogatorily, Lapides quipped. Basically, he was never discussed. My impressions of Jesus came from seeing Catholic churches. There was the cross, the crown of thorns, the pierced side, the blood coming from his head. It didn't make any sense to me. Why would you worship a man on a cross with nails in his hands and feet? I never once thought Jesus had any connection to the Jewish people. I just thought he was a God of the Gentiles. Now look, you're looking into the brain, into the mind of a man who was raised in the Jewish community who never heard the Messiah discussed. Not talking about Jesus. He never heard the Messiah discussed. He thought that Jesus was a God of the Jew, of the Gentiles, not the Jews. Well, I thought he was a God of the Gentiles. Well, he goes on and tells about his conversion experience. A minister there on the street gave him a copy of the Bible. And he said, would you read this? And he said, is the New Testament in there? He said, yes. He said, well, I'm not going to read that. But he took it and he said, I'll read the Old Testament. He never had read the Old Testament. He began reading. Pretty soon, Lapides told me, I was reading the Old Testament every day and seeing one prophecy after another. For instance, Deuteronomy talked about a prophet greater than Moses who will come and whom we should listen to. I thought, who can be greater than Moses? It sounded like the Messiah, someone as great and as Moses. It sounded like someone as great and as respected as Moses, but a greater teacher and a greater authority. I grabbed a hold of that and went searching for him. As Lapides progressed through the scriptures, he was stopped cold by Isaiah 53. With clarity and specificity in a haunting prediction wrapped in exquisite poetry, here was the picture of a Messiah who would suffer and die for the sins of Israel and for the world. All written more than 700 years before Jesus walked the earth. And then he quotes Isaiah 53. He was despised and rejected. A man of sorrows and familiar with suffering. Like one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised, and we didn't recognize him. Surely he took our infirmities and carried our sorrows, yet we thought he was stricken by God, smitten and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. And he goes on down, and he just simply said, instantly, Lapides recognized the portrait. This was Jesus of Nazareth. Now he was beginning to understand the paintings he had seen in the Catholic churches he had passed as a child. The suffering Jesus, the crucified Jesus, the Jesus who he now realized had been pierced for our transgression. So breathtaking was this discovery that Lapides could only come to one conclusion. It was a fraud. Now listen to this. It was a fraud. He believed that Christians had rewritten the Old Testament and twisted Isaiah's words to make it sound as if the prophet had been foreshadowing Jesus. Lapides set out to expose this deception. I asked my grandmother, he said, to send me a Jewish Bible so I could check it out myself. She did, and guess what? I found that it said the same thing. Now I really had to deal with it. I decided to open the New Testament and just read the first page. Open your New Testaments and read the first to Matthew. Open your Bibles to Matthew chapter 1, verse 1. George, read Matthew 1:1. George is, he's old and slow. Would one of you students who have better reflexes, would you read Matthew 1:1? Whoa. The book of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. He says, I thought, wow, son of Abraham, son of David? It was all fitting together. I went to the birth narratives and thought, look at this. Matthew is quoting from Isaiah 7:14. The virgin shall be with child and give birth to a son. Then I saw him quoting from the prophet Jeremiah. I sat there thinking, you know, this is about Jewish people. Where do the Gentiles come in? What's going on here? I couldn't put it down, he said. I read through the rest of the Gospels and I realized this was not a handbook for American Nazi Party. Now, he'd been told that the New Testament was a handbook for the American Nazi Party. It was an interaction between Jesus and the Jewish community. I got to the book of Acts and he said, this was incredible. They were trying to figure out how the Jews could bring the story of Jesus to the Gentiles. Talk about role reversal, he says. My goodness. This man makes a reference to one other. I called this morning to a doctor in Little Rock, Dr. Kent Westbrook. In this book here, he mentions other Jewish people. There was Jack Sternberg, a prominent cancer physician in Little Rock, Arkansas, who was so alarmed at what he found in the Old Testament that he challenged three rabbis to disprove that Jesus was the Messiah. They couldn't. And he too has claimed to have found wholeness in Christ. Well, I don't, you know, believe everything that you read. You can't afford to. But when he mentioned Little Rock, Arkansas, my ears perked up, and I know the head of the cancer research there. It's Dr. Westbrook, Dr. Kent Westbrook. So I called him last night. I couldn't get him. Called him again this morning. He was in the shower, and I didn't get him again. He called me back, and I said, I'm just checking on this Dr. Sternberg. Do you know him? He said, oh, yes, I know him. I know him. He's a New York type fella. He's not a southerner. He comes across like a New York shoe salesman. And when it says he said, I don't know about him challenging three rabbi, but knowing him, I can full well believe that he did. He said, yes, he's a genuine Christian. His conversion was genuine. In fact, he says he goes around speaking, telling other people of his conversion. His wife also converted. I'm just so sorry that the major part, well, 99% of the Jewish nation, they don't believe in Jesus. When we were over in coming through Israel in 1970, I rode in a truck with girls and boys who were scouts. We went up to Mount Arbel, just overlooking the Sea of Galilee, and they came roaring into our campground. We were camping down by the Sea of Galilee that night. About 4 o'clock, they came roaring in there with horns blaring and lights glaring. And I got up and grabbed my tape recorder and took off and asked, what's going on? And they said, well, we've just completed a 70-kilometer trek and we're on our way up to Mount Arbel at 6 o'clock for a history lesson. And I said to the leader, I said, can I go? And he said, yeah. Sure. So I got in the back of the truck with these 20 or 30 young people, Jewish young people, and had an opportunity to tell them who I was. They spoke English as well as you and I do. And I shared my faith in Jesus with them. Boy, they didn't bat an eye. They listened to me without ever looking away or without batting an eye. And at the end of my brief witness to them, one of them said, I wish I had a faith like that. Do you know what percentage of the Jewish nation is not only agnostic when it comes, or not only they don't believe in Jesus Christ? Do you know what percentage of the Israeli nation right now, the Israelis, you know what percentage of them are atheistic? They don't believe in God. About 80%. About 80% of modern-day Israel does not even believe in God. just breaks your heart. Breaks your heart. Ellis Sloan married Laurie Pryor here in Searcy, teaches on a college campus. He is a converted Jew. He tells about his conversion. He says, as he and Laurie had studied, he said a Jewish man who had converted to Christianity asked him, "Would you read for me Isaiah 53? Oh no, he didn't say Isaiah 53. He read this to Ellis. He read this to Ellis, Isaiah 53. And he said, "I want to ask you two questions. Of whom is this a description? To whom is this referring?" And then he said, "I want you to tell me where it's found." Now this was after Ellis's conversion. He said, "Take this to a friend of yours who is Jewish and ask him these two questions. Read him this, but don't tell him where it's found." And he said, "After you've read it to him, then ask him, who is this describing?" And he said, "Invariably, the modern day Jew will tell you, well, that's describing Christ." And then the second question is, ask them, where is it found? And invariably, they will answer, "Oh, it's in some of their Christian writings." And then drop the other shoe and say, "No, this is one of your own Hebrew prophets. And he made this prophecy 700 years before Jesus of Nazareth was ever born." Boy, Ellis tells about his conversion. He was converted through the Old Testament prophecies. And so was Lapides, and so was the Jewish people. That's the door they have to come through. They have to come in before the intermission. And then they will, if they dare. He said he opened the New Testament, and he said, "I decided to open the New Testament and just read the first page." And he says, "With trepidation, I slowly turned to Matthew as I looked up to heaven, waiting for the bolt of lightning to strike." That's how he had been programmed against this connection between the old and the new, between the prophecies and the fulfillment. Now, I don't know whether you want to or not. You may not come back. You want to come back next week to see how believing in God is about the same thing as being hit by a car. Come back. I think you'll see what we're talking about. And then the next one, we're going to undo and let you see. We're going to expose the backbone of the Bible. But come back. I don't know how long that will prolong or proceed, but maybe 3 or 4 weeks beyond that. But you're going to be looking at this connectedness that will give you a historical rooting where your faith, it won't depend upon looking at the church. If you're waiting to look at the church and find validation for your faith in God, you know what you're going to find? You're going to be terribly disappointed. Because we're just a bunch of untogether, broken, crushed people who are trying their dead level best to hang on as long as they can. You're going to find a lot of imperfection if you look into the church to confirm your faith in God and in Jesus Christ. But I'll guarantee you, if you'll fix your eyes on Jesus and watch Him closely and check out all of the references to Him in the Old Testament and watch how He fulfilled them all, you're going to be absolutely blown away. The possibility of Jesus, and He tracks this down, the possibility of His being the fulfillment of the Old Testament prophecies, of one man fulfilling all of them. Look, he said, "I asked Lapides whether it's possible that Jesus really fulfilled the prophecies by accident. Maybe He's just one of many throughout history who have coincidentally fit the prophetic fingerprint." "Not a chance," said this Jewish man. "The odds are so astronomical that they rule that out. Someone did the math and figured out that the probability of just 8 prophecies being fulfilled is 1 chance in 100 million billion. That number is millions of times greater than the total number of people who have ever walked this planet. He calculated that if you took this number of silver dollars, they would cover the state of Texas to a depth of 2 feet. The whole state of Texas, and it would cover it up to the depth of 2 feet, silver dollars. If you marked one silver dollar among them and then had a blindfolded person wander the whole state and bend down and pick up one coin, what would be the odds he'd choose the one that had been marked? With that, he answered his own question. The same odds that anybody in history could have fulfilled just 8 of the prophecies of the coming Messiah. Oh my. Here's a figure I want to read, and then I'm going to sit down. He said, I studied this same statistical analysis by mathematician Peter W. Stoner when I was investigating the messianic prophecies for myself. Stoner also computed that the probability of fulfilling the 48 prophecies, there are 48 prophecies, specific prophecies referring to the Messiah. There are 48 of them. He said that the staggering statistic, Stoner computed that the probability of fulfilling 48 prophecies was one chance in a trillion, 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 trillion. Our minds can't comprehend the number that big. Sounds like the deficit. Sounds like the America, the U.S. deficit. Well, it's so unbelievable. You can't believe it. Okay, come back next Sunday. We'll pick up from here and do some thinking further. And I'm trying to draw us all into the historical reality of what you're a part of. Okay.